Weight loss solutions are not one-size-fits-all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to 40K Lorecast with me, John Barsani, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
On today's cast, we're going to finish our coverage, well, sort of the Nephilim.
Like,
war.
No, we're not.
Crusade. Well, we're going to, like,
John, sort of. Why do you turn this podcast into a house of lies?
It's more fun that way. We're going to stop talking about it after this podcast for a bit. How's that for an answer?
Fine. Yeah. Hey, we are going to cliffhanger the hell out of you guys. Spoiler.
That's not our fault. GW did it. So this is me just passing the buck. Here it is.
It's literally Royal Rumble that's going to go.
Yeah.
See you later, guys.
Yeah. It's basically someone's got a hot plate and handed me a hot plate and went, here's a hot plate. And I went, cool. Let me give the next person. They can have that hot plate. 40K Lorecast, the weekly show in the lore of Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Please continue following and commenting the show. It does help us out a lot, guys. It's really great to see how far and how high up we are ranked. I am competitive, and the other people in the Leisure Podcast group can suck it. Anyway.
I went back in the top 100.
We'll see. Dawn of War 4 is coming out. Wait, you'll see. Like we'll crank again. And if
Henry
Cavill's show ever comes out, who knows? Dawn of War 4, by the way, you and I got to record like 10 episodes in advance because I'm gone for 2 or 3 weeks. Just letting you know. Like,
you know what we could do, John, for the YouTube page? We could do some playthroughs with peeps.
No, I want to play in peace. I just want to sit there and play my Dawn of War 4, unless it's like Dawn of War 3, in which case I won't play very much of it.
I mean, I, however, really like people to play, hang out with me.
Yeah, I'm good. I want to hang out in my dungeon. If you like the show and you want more of Brad and I, you can come over to the link to our YouTube page. There you'll find old versions of the show converted over with imagery, our live Q&A sessions, which we do have another one coming up, and our other shows, The History of 40K and Two Old Men and Their Handler. Additionally, in the show notes is a link to our Patreon. Massive thank you to all the people who have joined our Patreon so far and are helping us out. It is really helping us expand quite a bit. Well beyond the initial pieces of new equipment, we now are on YouTube. We're able to actually do a lot more stuff than we ever could before. We've got streaming platforms, all this stuff. So huge thank you. For those of you who want to support it, it's only $4.99 American or 616.72 Icelandic krona. Most of us are aware that Iceland is loaded with natural beauty from its volcanoes, glaciers, and really crazy landscapes. But did you know it's actually one of the world's oldest governments? Established in 930 AD, Althingi is what I think you pronounce that, has been ruling the country as it's their parliament ever since.
It's not over even nine, close. I love Althingi? It. Just continue.
All right. Anyway, this thing was started in 930, which puts it almost 900 years before the English parliament. Also, even more interesting to me, there's not a single McDonald's in the entire country. The last one closed in 2009. Good for you, Iceland.
Well done.
Good for you. Good for you. Lastly, by the way, guys, I'm going to keep doing that every week. So welcome to Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego 2025 edition with this voice. Anyway, lastly, we do also have... We've got our Discord, a link in the show notes for people looking to interact more about Warhammer. It's an incredible community that I could not take more pride in. Great place to interact with Brad and myself, but more importantly, to interact with other people who are like-minded and enjoy the Warhammer 40K universe, the lore, etc. We've got great spots for literature recommendations. Probably the number one thing I think we'll do in there is literature and gameplay recommendation outside of just screwing around and posting memes, even pets, food, workouts, everything. Come on in. Big thank you to the moderator team, who's actually the ones who built the thing. I clicked the buttons and made it happen. They're the ones who actually made the whole thing function.
Don't let him burn it down, kids. Don't let it burn him down.
One day I'm going to burn this thing down. They all know it. Everyone's aware that one day I get to press that button. I just don't know when that day is. It could be 27, could be 2030. Who knows? But one day I'm pressing that button.
One day.
Onto the cast. So in our last cast, we talked about the Kaladesh battle group entering the Nephilim sector. They were the first ones to really see the effects of the pylons and the stilling firsthand. Well, people had seen it before, but they were all dead. They're the first ones to report on it. Better way of saying it. After pushing forward, they discovered this massive Necron pylon on a world named Mesmok. And it's just upon its discovery, the group master named Marin realized he'd found the first of his targets in the system. But what Marin didn't realize is that he'd been watched the entire time. And not just watched, by the way, watched and monitored.
I would say studied to be more accurate on that.
Yeah, probably. But what I'm trying to get is he also infiltrated in the sense that he's not just being studied, but what he's doing. Caesaros is not watching from a distance, saying like the notebook, like, oh, this is kind of interesting, like a documentary.
Yeah. Well, he infiltrated the computer systems of.
Yeah, exactly. That's why but Brad's right. He was trying to see what's going on. So Marin puts out this call across the system for all of his forces about the pylons. And he receives word back from all over the place that these pylons are present all across the sector from scout ships. At the same time, he's receiving word that the pylons were not unguarded. Necron forces are being seen on the ground and in orbit all around the systems. And some had already started attacking the scout groups that had gone in. Is a very good fleet commander. And the reason I point that out is a lot of times in GW writing, someone like this would be adult. It's, oh, he fell for a trap. No, Marin's very, very good. And Marin realizes pretty quickly that he cannot handle the Necrons spread out. So he decides, I'm going to go kind of what the US did with the island hopping in World War II. I'm just going to pick key areas, blow them up, and move on from there.
Let's say he pulls all his forces together, centralizes them, and then goes, they can't beat this centralized basically pocket of force. We can't take them on if we try to hit them where they are, which is everywhere in the system.
Yeah.
Or the sector. But we can win individualized small wars everywhere.
Yeah, except he was totally wrong on that. He could get his ass kicked.
Oh, yeah. So I'm just saying that's what his strategy was.
No, you're right. His strategy was that. The truth doesn't go that well. So he decides to start at Mesmok because it's the largest pylon discovered so far. So he assumed if I blow up this one, probably has a good effect. Unfortunately, the Necrons had been calculating this plan since they started putting the pylons down. Caesaros knew would muster all his
forces. Well, I love this. You know why he knows this? Because in almost infinite amount of simulations they ran, already this happened. So he's already ready for this.
Numerous times, by the way. Yeah, they knew they would do this. The big problem is that as Marin begins to do this, the first problem he runs into is the power of the pylon was so much that disrupted the warp travel in and out of the system. So when Marin's force arrived, it was kind of hodgepodge. Only 2/3 of the fleet arrived, and they were spread all over the place and delayed in transit. The bigger problem, though, is that when they got there, they forgot how fast Necrons can arrive.
Which is instantaneous. So
yeah.
They were showing up in ones and twos, and the Necrons showed up with yes.
Yeah, so what the Necrons are able to do is they have something very similar to Eldar Webway. Whereas the Eldar actually use the Webway portals to travel through, the Necrons have something that it lines up. They have Dolmen gates, which is similar, but they also have phase shifting. So they've got two ways of moving through like this. But what they can do is appear in an instant in force. And that's exactly what happened. Suddenly, the planet Mesmok was covered in orbital defense platforms. So as they're getting closer to it, it just begins opening up. And then in space, a ton of Necron warships arrive. Marin knows this battle is going to be a total loss if he doesn't get rid of the pylon ASAP. So he deploys his forces planet side. The Ultramarines actually lead the attack, supported by Black Templar, Death Watch.
Yeah. Kill Teams, Imperial Guard. But also the Ultramarines are leading the attack because If you're going to get heavy fire, you need somebody that's covered in thick-ass plot armor.
Oh, it's a very good thing. Because, yeah, they do... It's actually not even a big squad of Space Marines, but they also did have a Warlord Titan, I should point out. The fleet in orbit begins just bombarding the pylon from space, and this turn, all of this, though, was fleeting at best. This an Apocalypse-class warship unloaded a full barrage at it, and the best I can give the example of, and I know people don't love this movie, but Star Wars Episode 8...
Hate this movie, but continue.
No, 8's... Look, the thing we talk about hating Star Wars movies, 8 doesn't make the top 3.
You're high on crack cocaine.
What are the worst? 1? 2?
No. 8 is so bad. Well, 9's really bad, too.
That's my point. 1 and 9 are definitely the worst, and I would think, I would argue 2's worse than 8.
I don't know. Duel of the Fates came out of 1, though. Cool yeah. song anyway. And cool
so- In Episode 8, there's the scene where they shoot everything at Skywalker, and then it finishes, he's just standing there. That's what happened here. They fired everything at the pylon, and then as soon as the dust cleared, the pylon was just hanging out.
But unlike Skywalker, the pylon was actually there. They just had it shielded.
Yeah, and the issue they realized pretty quickly is the Necron possess these force fields that can completely negate distance bombardment, which they also kind of stole from Dune, if I'm being honest. That's how the Dune shields work. It's why everyone in Dune is to stab everybody. They realize they have to get close, and that becomes the next plan. Let's get really close, and then we'll blow it up when we're right next to it. This doesn't go great, candidly. The Necrons, encountered by Imperial forces outside of maybe the AdMech, had always been partially awakened tomb worlds or isolated ones. This world is neither. This world is a key world under the protection of Cesaros. The forces that they ran into are both coordinated by Cesaros, but also equipped by one of the largest dynasties in the galaxy. So the Imperial forces hit the greatest Necron foe they've probably ever faced. Well, actually, yeah, no, definitely the worst of it, because everyone who's faced a foe like this is dead. So for these people, this is the worst Necron they've ever had. Assaulting the pylon quickly turns from like a minor gain for the Imperial forces to a total rout and then a very furious retreat. By the time the landing crafts got back to the fleet in orbit, the losses were, I wouldn't say catastrophic, but highly significant. At the same time, though...
I would say catastrophic.
the reason I won't say catastrophic is because Marin does actually... He's able to get his forces back together later. If it's catastrophic, I would say it's over. You're right? Dispersed. So this wasn't over. Yeah, but this was bad. At the same time, though, Cesar has been popping these traps all over the place. He's... Every Imperial force in the entire sector is being overrun.
Well, let's set it up from before, though. They're not trying to kill all of them because in the end, the Necrons want someone so they can retake mortal form. And they also know that they need something to stop the Tyranids because so that was the whole plan is to get humanity kind of speed bumping the Tyranids for them. And for them to get their bodies back.
Yeah, and they did it in the most Necron fashion possible, where they just tried to exert dominance, expecting that everyone would just kowtow to them. Is it kowtow or cowtail? It's okay. Kowtow, is it? Okay, yeah. Kowtow. Fair enough. Everyone's just going to kowtow to them and say, yeah, all right, you guys should be our leaders. There's a lot of the movie Stargate floating around the Necron.
Oh, 100%.
Just like, not SG-1. We're not having this fight in Discord again, but I'm still standing by my statements from before. It's a great show. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, my viewpoint on Stargate SG-1, Briscoe County 2. There's a bunch of these, just sadly, files.
Yes. If you want to get riled up, John will occasionally pop in and go, things that you like suck, I'm out, and never follow up at all.
They don't suck. Just never watch them again. That's all I'm saying. The memory in my heart of some of these shows is fantastic. I tried rewatching them and I made it like 30 minutes. I'm like, I'm not going to ruin my childhood. I'm just turning this off right now and just let it sit as the perfect memory in the back of my brain. Anyway. All over the sector, the battle groups are under complete assault from the Necron forces. And the biggest problem they're running into is that in lore, Necrons are basically unstoppable. We play the game the tabletop, where they're very much so not. They're highly stoppable, except for that little blip in 9th edition where running, what was it, 60 scarabs? Oh. How many? Yeah,
we should. That was before.
That was 9th. That was 9th. It was ninth because it happened here. I was in Michigan, and Ninth Edition launched right before I moved to Michigan. It was ninth.
There's so many stuffs.
But anyway, the thing about Necrons in the lore is they excel in air and space combat. One of these Brad hates on the tabletop. The other one isn't on the tabletop. And this is because Necrons are living metal. They don't have internal organs. So G-forces just don't matter to them. We talk about the Eldar being able to handle high G-force. They're still living beings. The Necrons can do more. So Necron ships can move, stop, turn.
Well, you can do 180s basically, in midair. Yeah,
at impossible speeds. So one of the problems the Imperial Navy runs into, it's why they're just kind of their butts handed to them, is that they will lose 99% of their forces in a dogfight. They cannot dogfight against the Necrons. The only chance they have is to use high volumes of fire, where they just turn the ship sideways, fire all the guns like flat cannons.
Hold on. But to be fair, it's kind of the specialty of the Imperial forces to volume out whatever it is. That's their go-to. Hey, man, is this a tricky, powerful foe that we don't understand? How about we just use either tons of bodies, tons of volume of fire, tons of people, period. And that's just what we're going to do. We'll just cover the sky with bullets and see how it works out.
Yeah. The Imperial forces use this now. They realize that these battles are being lost. They have to retreat from all these areas and reform again somewhere else. So they do exactly what Brad said. They just turn the ships to the side and fire all the guns to retreat. The problem is that Cesaros is not done with his trap yet. He effectively turns the pylons up to an 11. You might ask, why not just make 10 the loudest? It's because these pylons go to 11.
Turn it up. Spinal Tap, that crap.
It's so, God, that movie is good. And I'm so excited for the sequel. But as the Imperial forces try to muster and use the warp to get out, they discover there's no warp. Their warp drives just won't engage. Well,
the navigators have nothing to navigate because it's just, yeah. They look outside and go, hey, I can see blackness, period. Nothing else.
Yeah. And so they have to make like an FTL retreat back out of the system. Now, I have to be honest, guys, what we're going to describe here, I'm going to do what sounds like a jump. This is happening at about the same time because the entirety of the Indomitus Crusade, everything's happening all at once ever. So while this is occurring in one section, there's another section that's also under attack, for lack of a better phrase. But this one involves the Sisters of Battle. And this ends up flipping it around back for the Imperium. The Sisters of Battle had been fighting Word Bearers, actually, on the edge of the Nephilim sector. Obviously not in it, because the Word Bearers wouldn't have enjoyed being under the pylon effect. When word came that the Imperium had been taking heavy casualties, though, the Sisters deployed to the area to support. Because remember, the Sisters are multiple groups. You've got the Sisters of Battle, which we play on the tabletop, but you also have the Sisters who are nurses and medical aid. So when the Imperium is struggling, they deploy to those areas.
Because the Sisters have different orders. They're hugely the medical, the help. They have the preachers. The Sisters of Battle, the ecclesiarchy is gigantic. And the Sisters of Battle are a huge arm of that. And they have more than just the fighters.
Yeah, I mean,
the fighters are actually a smaller portion than everything else Sisters have.
The Sisters are likely. I think I'm assuming it's probably Imperial Army, so Guard, then Navy, then Sisters. It would be my guess in size. Arbites possibly could be in there, but as far as like official arms, it would be somewhere in that realm. That's how I would put it. So the key thing about this is that the Sisters deployed to these worlds where there are endless casualties, and these are worlds under the effect of the Stilling. When they get there, unlike the Commissars, and they see these people who are effectively giving up on life, they don't just start executing them. What the Sisters begin doing is actually encouraging them, preaching the light of the Emperor and telling them, hey, through the Emperor, you can regain yourself, regain your composure. And the interesting piece here is that this whole time when the Sisters are, this is a scene in the book, by the way, it's well written. The Sisters who are present in this area don't feel the effects of the Stilling. So they're actually at 100% just walking around. And what the Sisters start doing is they start preaching to them, believe in the Emperor. He is your guidance, whatever. And people start getting up. The Stilling starts to vanish. It's like all we know about this situation is that in the Nephilim sector, the Sisters of Battle felt none of the ill effects of the Stilling. they actually were outperforming Space Marines because of that. And when Imperial soldiers were around them, it, not so much like an aura from them, but hearing their battle cries and their encouragement into believing in the Emperor and supporting the Emperor, they actually started feeling less of the effects of the stilling. And GW never really explains how this works or any of the stuff that the sisters do. So either it's the power of the Emperor is so great that even with the pylons in place, he can reach through the warp and still power it.
Read the primer, John. Read the primer. The Emperor protects.
Exactly. But I'm saying, how does he protect it? I don't really know.
Whoa. That sounds like some heretical kind of speech that you're giving right there. What do you mean, how? It just does.
Yeah, but I like the how. The other one is possible that the Emperor's power doesn't come from the warp at all, but from the materium. Because is it, and this is where I think it might be. I think the Emperor is so powerful that when he was created, he became part of humanity itself. And that's why, like, how the Golden Throne works, how all these things work. He's almost, for those who don't know, like Genghis Khan, I think is related to like 6% of the entire human population.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in that realm, but not as gross. I think the Emperor may actually, all of the citizens in the Imperium may actually have some sort of physical connection to the Emperor, be at the molecular level. So he's able to reach through to them, channel through. We are not going to do one of those stupid things in Star Wars that ruined the Force for me.
Ugh, please don't. I refuse to talk. No, I won't talk about it. Right, I will not talk about the Metachlorians.
Thank you.
At all.
Yeah, no. Ruined everything. So anyway, long story short, the sisters aren't affected by the stilling. And that's going to matter a lot because the next part of the Pariah Crusade gets a little bit goofy. Ephriel Stern. So Ephriel Stern.
And Kaganel.
When we did our coverage of the Sisters of Battle, we hinted at Ephriel Stern and didn't cover her. I had to go back and check that, by the way. So I'm going to do a quick hit on her real quick to clean up some of the backstory. Ephriel Stern may be the most faithful of all the Sisters of Battle, although not perfectly attuned to all of their teachings. So yeah. Stern.
Is she cruising with an Eldar? Yeah.
Well, a Harlequin. Makes it worse, actually, I think.
Yeah.
Actually, so Ephriel Stern was a sister superior in a convent called Parnas. This convent got targeted and overtaken by a keeper of secrets. The keeper then linked all of their bodies and minds together of all the sisters there to torture them as one, to maximize the joy and the for her and the pain and suffering for all of them. It was
Screaming
called
Cage.
Yeah. The plan backfired, though, because all the linked sisters poured all of their, what was left of their souls and energy into Ephriel Stern, and she was able to escape. Stern, like, she doesn't escape yet, into Stern. Stern then kills herself, which then released her from the screaming cage, and then the remaining sister's energy resurrected her outside of the cage. We've all done this move in video games.
That is super cool game-wise. They do this in the game. Because the characters can instantly get back up.
Yeah. So she then escapes. But what's fascinating is that she escapes and is found by the sisters. And the sisters are not thrilled at what they find because she was just with, for years potentially, under the effect of the Keeper of Secrets. So they literally lock her away for, I want to say it was a decade. Maybe it wasn't a decade, but they locked her away for a very long time. And just kept checking for any sign of corruption.
Corruption. There was none. Because they thought she was a sleeper agent, basically.
Yeah. No corruption at all. But she's imbued now with the warp, but no corruption. And there's more to her backstory. There's literally three novels that she takes part in, or maybe they're graphic novels, but still more than what
she's got both on that. It's really cool. Yeah. I like her as a character quite a bit, even when she meets Kat.
I do too. I think she's way more interesting than Saint Celestine. I think, but she's probably number two to Saint Celestine in power. And depending on the novel, she might be number one. That's how rough she is. But to Brett's point, she also does travel around with a former Harlequin. There's a lot going on there. But Ephriel Stern.
She's cool.
She's cool as hell. And the model's good, not great. Just candidly, it's good, not great.
You know, for us Eldar players, it was super annoying for the first new Eldar of 10th edition to be a sister's model, by the way.
That was funny, actually. Then we got a bunch of models, and everyone got excited, and they rebased all of our models, and we all got less excited.
Boo.
If you guys don't play Eldar, just understand, there's a lot of us who've been playing them forever. GW did us the great joy of giving us a model update for the first time in 20 years, and then told us that if we had the old models, we had to go buy a bunch of base extenders and rebase all of our models because they changed all the sizes.
3 millimeters.
Yeah, it was a lot. Some of them were actually a lot. Anyway, Etsy solves problems. So, Ephril Stern is in the area, and she hears about the great loss that Marin the Force took, and she goes to him. And says, look, let me lead a counterattack into the Necrons. And this is for two reasons. One, she wants to bolster the campaign by claiming some land and destroying Necrons.
I think this is one of the bigger things, because people, there is low morale. Because they just got, they're doing the Paxton of, I don't know if you keep a score, man, we just got our ass kicked.
Yeah, exactly.
They are not happy.
They're not doing well. And they also have a stilling overwhelming them to make it even worse. Marin agrees after, because he'd heard about how the sisters were actually able to hold up against the Necrons and the stilling wasn't affecting them. But Marin does something. That's why I like Marin. He doesn't do the, let's give him a small force and see if it works out. He gives Stern the majority of what was left of his battle group. After the defeat of the Mesmok, Marin knew that the Imperial forces were doomed unless they could turn the tide here. And the force of the Necrons were bringing to bear was so great, like a small incursion to see if this would work would auto fail. So he goes all in with Stern.
I love everything that comes up to here. The choice of where they decide to fight is
so stupid,
suboptimal.
All right, so this is GW just gets a little too dramatic sometimes. We make the Spinal Tap joke of the 11. They love to turn key moments at an 11. We're in 7 would be great, guys. So they decide that we're going to go and we're going to push back into the Necrons. And so what do they choose? They choose Cherist, which
so
is
many. You could have chosen, though. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. But like that, this is so dumb.
Well, this one's incredible. This is let me get through all the details of this so you guys understand how dumb this is of a choice. It's an Arctic death world. And what they mean by that is it has blizzards of razor sharp ice, low light. So it's all night fight. We're bringing it back, Brad. Night fight's back. 11th edition. Geysers of liquid nitrogen. So if you're a T-1000, you also would die here. These are all things that are fatal to humans and not to living metal robots. So good choice, Imperium. But it takes me out of it how dumb this world is. But the Imperium did learn their lesson. And rather than attack the Necrons directly with ordnance, they actually used the planet against them. So what they did was the Necrons had a bunch of shielding around the tomb worlds they had there. So from orbit, they just blow up the mountains that are right next to them or enough of the land in front of them to just collapse them into the ground. So either a mountain fell on top of the tomb world or the tomb world itself fell down into a chasm. Pretty good move. And this opening salvo gets the attention of the Necrons, who come launching themselves out to meet the attackers. But Ephriel Stern was correct. The light of the Emperor did shine within the attackers. And rather than quickly overwhelm them, which were the Necrons expected, the Necrons found themselves in a pitched battle with the Imperium. And then we get into 40 pages of GW writing of the battle going back and forth, where certain victory becomes certain defeat, and then glimmer of hope, and blah, blah, blah. But a couple of key moments happen, namely when Ephriel Stern sees the tide turning against her, and she feels within herself a lack of faith in the Emperor, which she doesn't think very highly of. And then she goes, I can't pronounce this, Brad. I didn't
Super Scion.
Thank you. Super Scion or Scion?
Scion.
All right. Super Scion.
And then she can
do this, by the way.
She starts going nuts. She basically does the Wyatt Earp moment when he's just no and walks into the middle of the river, which is what she does.
Yeah, so she solos the leader of the Necrons and all of its Lich Guard.
Which is bananas, all of the, by the way.
of Necron. Yeah, the leader of the Necron forces, Farron Shemvok, who believed the powers of the warp wouldn't work here, dies at her hand.
Let's say what she is. She turns into what's called in the game in the Demon Fuge.
Yep, which is Super Scion Sister.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest, on the tabletop, I wouldn't really go super Sion. I'd go, meh, Sion.
Yeah, she's good. That's
yeah. About it. But I mean, yes, it's more, if you could turn it from 1 to 11 on the tabletop, she goes like maybe a 3.5.
Also on the tabletop, there's zero chance she's killing the entire unit of Lich Guard, but continue.
Yeah, Necrons are actually one of the armies. We've discussed this before, that the Custodes are the worst lore to tabletop, but Necrons are actually up there.
Pretty close.
Because in the lore, they are insane. And then, but it's fine. Whatever. All right. While Ephriel Stern's doing this, Cezaros is watching. He's kind of a mix of horrified and intrigued. He didn't care that this Imperials murdered other Necrons. That means nothing. But he's a being of science at its core, and he's watching this happen. He can't figure out how the humans with their god emperor.
I think this is a big deal for in the book and in the turning point, because he didn't believe that this was a real thing. And then yes. He actually saw the power of the emperor, because he just thought it was just a battle cry for them. And it wasn't a real thing before.
Yeah, the way I looked at it was, I think Cezaros assumed and believed that the emperor was just a super powerful psyker who used the warp. And he viewed him almost like a street magician using magic to convince everyone he was the most powerful being. And now he's seeing, no, there's real power here.
Yeah.
There's something in the Imperium that they don't understand.
Until now, he thought he was a charlatan. He was just all smoke and mirrors.
And of course, Cezaros's next thought is, how do we harness this? I'll be honest, the Necrons and the Admech are really close, and they're both kind of entertaining. But what matters at this moment is the Imperium had won a decisive battle, and hope was restored again.
Which was the main whole reason for this, is to get the people back to fight against the Stilling, to fight against the Necrons, yep. Not just give in.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Now, and another part of the same sector near this time, because guys, in the book, it doesn't give timestamps. This is all just written out in paragraph form. So I don't know the exact order this is happening. It's all happening probably around the same time. We covered Inquisitor Draxus last time. She's the Inquisitor with the Green Dragon. That's how I describe her. She was working to understand how to pull down the network of pylons. And what she realized is that the Imperium could not afford to destroy them from orbit for two reasons. First, once they started to attack them, the Necrons would just phase into the system with an overwhelming force, and this all-out assault would just devastate the fleet. So you'd lead to just Pyrrhic victory after Pyrrhic victory until you couldn't actually have a victory anymore, because there were just too many pylons for them to take these kinds of losses for. The bigger problem they found was also that when they destroyed the pylon, they took the world with them.
Yeah, they were breaking the world in half.
It was an exterminatus. And again, the Book of Silent King, they cover this really well, what it's like when they do this. They launch it and the atmosphere collapses, everything falls apart, and they turn the world into a death world. Well, what's the damn point then of conquering this part of the galaxy if everywhere you conquer, you have to destroy? So they have to find a way to pull these things down without catastrophic losses for the Imperium or destroying the world itself. And they get their first breakthrough in what's called the Tredica system. Probably pronounced that way. I'm going with Tredica. Sorry, guys. it's just the way this stuff goes when I have to read this. An Imperial task force of Scions, which are the special forces of the Imperial Guard, had returned with vid recordings of a pylon network. Inquisitor Draxus reviewed the recordings and saw something, what appeared to be effectively a control center sitting in there. And she realized if she could access that, then maybe she could figure out how the pylon network worked and thereby disable it.
However, as Admiral Ackbar would say, it's a trap.
Yeah. The Scions had actually been captured by the Necrons and had mind scarabs implanted into them. These are, it's nanotechnology scarabs that the Necrons use.
Nanotechnology.
That the Necrons use to both mind control beings, but also see through them. This way, getting spies in twofold. First, they'll give over false information, but also they'll actually transmit information to you. The good news for the Imperium is Draxus was aware of that technology within the Necrons, and she knew the science of it. So she knew that the information the Scions brought was both accurate, but it was also a trap and somewhat incomplete. So if she could just avoid the trap, the reward is real, though, so worth it. Draxus puts together a pretty ballsy plan, if I'm being honest. First, also, puts a ton of fake planning.
It's not even just fake planning. Draxus puts on a full theater production in front of the Scions.
Yes. And for those of us who are big history buffs, in World War II, this is what the Allies did within England to make the Germans look at it and think it was over there, but secretly go somewhere else. That's what they did. The fun part about this is that the reason it worked is because as smart as Cesaras is, he's also an elitist. So he assumed the humans were too stupid to know his tricks. So he fell for all of these feints. The next thing that Draxus knew, though, was that the Sisters of Battle could resist the effects of the Stilling. So she goes and grabs Ephriel Stern to join her on this little adventure. So I said, I don't know the order of operation here.
We should also throw out, because in the book, they don't talk about it a lot, but everybody around the Sisters apparently at least has some sort of resistance to the Stilling.
Yeah, it's in the more recent one. They talk about this. The Sisters, when they keep preaching the God Emperor to everybody, and if you start preaching it back to them, he then fills you. And so it removes the Stilling as an effect.
Yeah, you get like a shield from it.
Yeah. What Draxus realizes is that if she brings enough forces, the Necrons would be engaged for a while and her strike force could hit the Inner Sanctum. Also, I should note, in these books, the amount of Imperial soldiers that just get sacrificed to the Necrons and faints is not small. This is like the third time that we're going to do a faint where people are going to die. Anyway.
Yeah, when we say a faint and a few people are going to die, it's millions of people each time.
Yeah.
The losses are wild.
Yeah, these are entire multiple regiments, and we're about to talk about some Space Marines. So arriving in Tredica, everything goes to plan. The Black Templars, because easy to sacrifice, they lead one raid. Sisters of Battle and Guard Special Forces of Science lead another. And this two-front campaign targeted all the key installations around Tredica, because Tredica was a key world in the Necron Empire, but there were key manufacturing areas, etc. So the Necrons respond in force. While this is happening, Draxus and her retinue drop right next to the pylon. The Necrons are focused elsewhere, so Draxus and team were actually able to deploy to the area pretty quickly, and it was her, Sisters, Death Watch, Admech, they move into position. However, once they get close enough, Cesaras becomes aware, and he attacks, bringing in first aircraft and then a massive ground support, because his goal was, all right, I fell for your trick, you all die. Now.
Yeah, he wants to make a point of it too. So he wants to overkill them to show the superiority, because he also leads the battle himself.
Yeah. Now, the problem for Cesaras is Draxus actually really knew what she was doing. She knew that the site was trapped from the vid recordings. What she saw in the vid recordings were the markings of Dolmen gates. Dolmen gates are the Necrons' version of a webway gate. They still do use the webway, but the difference is the Necrons can't walk around the webway the way that Eldar can, but they can use portals within it. And the Dolmen gates are portals within it. So the Necron plan was to use the aircraft, hit Draxus and her group, and then pop out of the Dolmen gates behind them, which would then make them retreat. And as they retreated, they could just mow them down as they went into Cesaras' next trap, because that's what the math said they would do. The problem is that Draxus knew this. So the second the Dolmen gates began engaging, Draxus and her crew ran towards the gates to attack the people coming out of it, forcing them back. Caesaros sees this, and Caesaros is very good, flips his attack and goes after them again. As he goes in, he's met with this massive blinding light, and it was from the Admech. The Admech had some sort of device, and they were able to use the dolmen gate to jump into the pylon. And then, part two. And part two is the even better part.
This is such surprise, because the Death Watch go, hey, man, you know what's better than one Meltabomb? All of the Meltabombs.
Yeah, the Death Watch left a solid middle finger surprise where every single one of those dolmen gates had actually been trapped. So as soon as Draxus and the crew go through the gate and disappear, all the gates blow up, leaving Caesaros on the other side and Draxus and team on the inside of the pylon.
To give credit, there was a whole bunch of them that just stayed and got blown up by their own bombs to make sure that they did it, though. So, boss mode move.
Oh, yeah, this is badass. Once inside, Draxus and the crew, the good news is Caesaros, his guys are outside. The bad news is Wraith Constructs, Scarabs, and Spiders are still all inside.
Yeah, it's everything that says Canoptic and then something in front of it.
Yes.
Because that's everybody that's inside that takes care of the manufacturing, the repair, and everything else. Scarab, Spiders, Rihanna, just, again, any Canoptic? Yes, it's inside here.
The next part of this, though, is super cool. So they keep pushing and fighting through them to get to the core. And in the core, they're searching for these data crystals. And inside these crystals is the knowledge that Draxus needs. So she just gets, he's going to hold these crystals and start basically diagnosing them. I don't know, like decoding them. But when she gets there, she finds something else. The power source of the pylon, which is a C-Tan. Well, C-Tan shard, not a full C-Tan. It's a C-Tan shard that is shackled inside there and is powering the entire complex.
This is so wild, though, because this is, pride is the downfall a bit of the Necrons in this, because you're using a piece of a star god just to kind of give an F you to them. We won. We enslaved your pieces. This is so dangerous.
But it's also, they do them a lot, though, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, they are.
Fine, guys.
It is a great alert. Power.
Rogue Trader, your final boss is a C-10 shard. Like, if you haven't beaten it by now, the game's over. You're like 2 years old now. It's on you. But there is a bunch of this stuff.
So fun. Also, make your either play on low difficulty level or make the most broken builds ever. Those games are so hard. Alcat doesn't mess around. Or do it.
Yeah, or use a save game editor like an adult. Dude, my life is hard. I don't need my video games to also be hard. I don't just need to live in a life of just labor and pain. I want to escape. Anyway, wave after wave of Necrons start crashing on Draxus, the crew, while she's trying to break apart these crystals and diagnose them, until eventually Caesaros himself shows up. But GW writing is GW writing. So as soon as Caesaros shows up and the force are circling in, she finally is able to decipher and decode the crystal and gets the information she needs. But it's kind of too late because there's no escape. Every route around them is cut off. So she does the only thing you should do in that situation. Throw on a power fist and start punching controls until the C-Tan gets out.
Who's not, I would say, less than happy.
Yeah, I think, was this Jurassic World 2 where they just let the T-Rex out? That was the going, screw it. I do like, by the way, this scene is funny because the C-Tan comes out, looks around, sees Necrons, and just beelines after the Necrons to go start beating the crap out of them. Caesaros starts just freaking out and doesn't even care about Draxus anymore.
Yeah, he just ignores the humans.
And at one point, the C-Tan, though, after just pulling a bunch of Necrons limb from limb, turns to Draxus and points at her. Draxus assumes, well, here's how I die. And then an instant later, her and her entire, what's left of her retinue, are on the bridge of her ship up in orbit. I guess the C-Tan gave her the good old Shooter McGavin. It wasn't the pointing at you angry, it was the, I got you here. At which point, by the way, Draxus and team, get out of Dodge. We're done. Everyone on the planet's probably dead anyway, but we're leaving now.
They're looking like at the end of Rogue One when they're trying to get the information. Go, go, go.
Just
with
go.
Vader right behind you.
Was that the greatest movie close you've ever seen?
Yes.
I think so. I can't. You know, I actually would say
you could get Unforgiven, but that's another
thing. I was going to say Departed. The end of Departed, where you discover, like, that one's also really a really good wrap up.
But it's long.
But not as good
just
as.
Just this is crazy.
Not as good as. Yeah. Anyway. So here's a fun story, guys. That whole story I just told you of Draxus and the C-10, all that stuff, that came from the Pariah Psychic Awakening book, which was released in June of 2020. In July of 2025, which was not that long ago.
1 month ago, after this recording.
Yeah. GW released a book called The Silent King. And in it, it turns out Call did all the same stuff Draxus did before Draxus did any of it. So we're going to cover that now. But it's not really a retcon. It's just more another layer. It's
also on the other side of the galaxy where Call was doing it.
No, it was also in Nephilim. This is all in Nephilim. That's the whole point.
Oh, I'm sorry, not the other side of the galaxy, the other side of the sector.
In the novel, it turns out the entire Kaladesh assault going on at Mezmuk and the areas was all a distraction by Call. Call knew that the Necrons would attack in force once they started pushing and attacking the pylons. And in doing so, he could create enough noise around it that a small group could then actually infiltrate one of the pylons. And this book's really cool because they actually use a drop pod to get down to the surface, but they have to pull all the machine spirit out of the drop pod and have to manually use the drop pod to hit it.
Well, let's talk about why. Because the Necrons can track machine spirits.
Yeah, because the machine spirit probably comes from Necron technology. Sorry, we know there's a shard of the Void Dragon sitting on Mars, and they've had access to it for 110,000 years. 100,000 years, a million years, who knows? But long story short, John theory, but I do believe that all machine spirits come from Necron technology. So anyway, they had to sneaky get down to the surface. They had to turn off all the machine spirit. Call and his group permeate the inner sanctum of this pylon, and Call, once he's there, does three things. First, he shuts down the Pariah network, which is what actually allows the Kaladesh battle group to escape.
Let's say temporarily.
Very temporarily. It's not down for long, but it's down for just enough.
He shuts the tractor beam controls, Obi-Wan style.
Yeah. The next thing he does is he downloads the workings of the pylon network so he can figure how it blocks out the warp. And the third one, and this sounds lame, but in the book it's really cool. He reveals that the inner sanctum of the pylon is actually a Pharos device, so it can actually teleport a la Star Trek. And so they do that. So they all just phase back up to their battleship and then again leave. And all of this is actually unknown to the Necrons because Call had a special device with him that all the Scarabs that were going around the tomb network that they were in thought they were other Necrons and just let them be. But once he gets back to his ship, Call goes to work and he starts calling for all in Noclith, which is the Imperial term for Blackstone, to be sent to him. And he starts building this device he calls the Luminal Abrasers. Why? I don't know.
Gotta be a cool
thing. Yeah. What these are is they're attached to ships and then drug along with the ships in the fleets. And they're a negative to the negative of the pylon network.
Yeah. He's, in the most basic of terms, he's trying to push away by his turning the magnets on each other so it forces away, but it kind of makes a warp bubble.
Yeah. So he basically brings access to the warp with him as he moves around. This obviously pulls the stilling effect off, but also makes warp travel functional.
Weirdly enough, it makes warp travel super accurate because they can only come where he is.
That's true. Yeah, it does make life a lot easier. And so he gets back, and this is where they retcon a little bit, so that now they blend together what Call's done with what Draxus has done. And what they come together and realize Call now has a way for the battle groups to get into the sector, move around the sector, and fight in the sector at full strength. Draxus has a solution where she's made a code that'll actually make the pylon implode on themselves, destroying themselves, and preserving the planet around.
I think that you meant to say, just like Independence Day, she had a plan to upload a virus into their network.
I completely forgot that was the plot of Independence Day. I haven't seen it in so long.
This is exactly what this is.
You're right. It is. It's not a great. It's fine. It was really cool when I was young. So now the Imperium can avoid the effects of the Stelling. They've got a way to destroy the pylons. All they have to do is land on them, infiltrate them, and they're off to the races. This was hard to do before what happens next.
The Silent King is the person that was getting all this together, and he took offense to what was happening. So,
yes. The Silent King shows up, and out the gate, this is quite bad for the Imperium, because the Silent King is two main things. One, he's a master tactician, incredible tactician. He also, though, commands all the dynasties of the Necrons. And so his presence and his force's presence increase the efficacy of other Necron forces. Silent King arrives.
He has battle meditation. He's also riding on a throne with two big old monoliths next to him that do a crazy amount of damage. He has basically ship weapons on his personal transport.
Yeah. And so the Silent King comes in and he starts unleashing hell on the Imperium. All of the Imperial advances halt and become retreats pretty quickly. And he's bringing boss mode stuff. One world, he unleashes a trillion scarabs that tear every single Imperial soldier, everything apart. So there's just almost basically a sea of goo is all that's left. On another one, he takes 5 C-Tan shards, which you never do, by the way. They're different C-Tans, obviously, but still 5 shards along with wraiths and annihilation barges and just destroy everything there.
You know, you could have said the annihilation barges annihilated them. Oh, yeah,
but to be fair, of those 3 things, 5 C-Tan shards, wraiths, and annihilation barges, the annihilation barges are actually the lowest tier on that group.
Oh, that is true. Yeah. You're not wrong.
Tabletop, they're great, but just lore standpoint, like, oh, there's also an annihilation bark. Oh, and the wraiths that phase in and out of reality can phase into your body and blow you up from the inside.
Well, it's just not great.
Yeah, those things.
Those sound scary. That does sound scary, but you know what's a little bit scarier is when the Silent King went, hey, I don't think you guys are moving fast enough. Get on it or die.
Yeah. And so the pylon network's next thing he does, he begins increasing the placement of the pylon network. And his goal is very clever here. It's not just to increase the size and the scope of the network, but to actually more be strategic in placement and then attack Imperials there. So you turn the Stilling up to an 11 and then attack immediately. So you've got them just completely back-footed and easy prey. Now, this is the part of the GW writing that we're going to get to where this seems to escalate like an Anchorman, where it just, man, that escalated quickly. Every GW, like war zone.
Chip tried it?
Yeah. Chip killed a guy. Yeah. Every GW writing is that at the end where you're like, what is happening? So as the war is faltering for the Imperials, Gilliman deploys himself and his battle group along with Call and his battle group to the sector,
which is a significant battle group of each.
And so now they start pushing the Necrons back. It's just this kind of stalemate, but the Imperium is going to get a lot of help from a very unlikely source right now. As the Silent King is doing this war in the Nephilim sector, not all of his dynastic subjects are following his lead to the letter. A bunch of them saw this increased power as opportunity. Because a Silent King enables Tomb Worlds to activate faster than normals. They're finding themselves at full strength or close to. And the Silent King brings resources. So your manufacturing, all that stuff is better. The Necrons are still going to Necron, guys. And
you're like, look, man, if you're going to turn your back to me, how am I going to knife you in the back? That's so effective.
Yeah. So while taking in all the support from the Silent King, a number of the smaller dynasties do raids into other small dynasties to kill them off because they just didn't really like them. So this is happening over in the area. Others were also taking vengeance. You had some who had issues with the orcs who were like, yeah, I don't care about these humans. Those orcs were an issue. I'm going to go make them not exist anymore. Or Death Watch or Admech. Anyone who'd really wronged them in the past, they're spreading out. So the Silent King is not quite the focused force that he wants to be and needs to be in this era. That, though, is nothing compared to what's going to happen next.
The Silent King right now has to be going, man, if only I had command protocols right now, I could force everybody to do exactly what I want them to immediately, as opposed to infighting with everybody and backstabbing and wandering aimlessly around.
Yeah, and the thing about Necron leadership is earned, but it also must be forcefully held. And so any sign of weakness is a chance for rivals to come in and try and challenge for power. So the war going on in the Nephilim sector with Gilliman and Kahl's arrival is now turned into basically World War One. It is in entrenched areas. The battles are just brutal attrition. Emotech the Stormlord sees his opportunity. Emotech does not agree with the Silent King's overall goals of reversing biotransference.
Oh, let's talk about it. Emotech thinks it's awesome to be in a necrodermis art.
He's made of instantly healing, incredibly strong material. He's all but immortal and invincible. He doesn't want to go back to being squishy. At the same time, he sees not only that in himself, but he sees this is how Necrons can conquer the galaxy. We are the superior being species in the galaxy. It's ours to take.
And also, it's ours to take forever, and I can rule forever.
Yeah, because Emotech also ran the largest and most powerful of dynasties, the Saltek. The Silent King had a large one, but the Saltek dynasty itself is the biggest and the most powerful. And they got there by force, by the way. They conquered a bunch of other Necron tomb worlds, enveloped a lot of their warriors into their own, and killed everybody in their way. They are massively powerful. Emotech has been biding his time since the return of the Silent King, waiting for a chance to challenge him for control of the Necrons. But he had to wait because the Silent King had to show weakness first. Once the Silent King shows weakness and then he can attack, all of the other dynasties would stay out of it because they don't want to get pulled into being on the wrong side.
In case he lost, exactly.
Yeah, because the Silent King loses and they were on Team Silent King, then they're getting Emotech's full wrath. And they also won't back Emotech because they don't want the Silent King's wrath. But so they all just play Switzerland.
Everybody's got a hat with two bills.
Sensing that the Silent King had been stalled out by a lesser species, Emotech makes his move. And in an instant, the civil war erupts all across the Nephilim sector as Necron forces appear and attack other Necron forces, sometimes destroying the Imperial forces that are there fighting with them, sometimes ignoring them completely. And at first, it's kind of funny. This is a huge boon for the Imperium. They're like, great, the Necrons are fractured and they start making massive gains. Draxus and Kahl are moving in. Their new tactic is pulling down pylons. But as they start pulling down these pylons, the Silent King gets pissed. And he decides, fun story on the Necrons. Much like the Admech, they've got a bunch of quote-unquote forbidden technology. Whereas the Necrons, it's not really forbidden. They just view it as unnecessary, as opposed to the Imperium, where the Admech are actively told, you never get to use this weapon
ever.
Because the difference is the Necrons will use a galaxy-destroying weapon when the galaxy has to be destroyed. The Admech will use it when they see a cockroach.
Yeah. Let's just see what happens if I push the big red button. But it says not to. Let's push it anyways.
Yeah. And the Necrons do in this situation would have this draw first blood. They deploy something called the Technomandroids, which are, they appear randomly in a few codexes and then in this one book. They are this collection of what are referred to as super cryptechs that date back to the war in heaven that the Necrons and the Silent King actually imprisoned because they were so afraid of the power that they wielded. There's not a lot of detail on them, guys. I'm giving you all that I have, by the way. They can outfit forces with the extreme weaponry, like world-destroying weaponry.
Wait, and so they kind of talk about it because they're uncontrolled world-destroying weaponry, as in you push the button and you hope that it blows up your enemy because it's going to do some destruction.
Yeah.
Where that goes, nobody knows.
Yeah, the Technomandroids just attack, and they're sent out, and they just start ripping apart this AdMech fleet. And the AdMech respond with something called the Ark of Oblivion, which is a great name. And the Ark of Oblivion is a missile in space, by the way, that when fired, breaks everything down. Brett and I discussed templates before. This is a large template that they then place in space, and everything under the template is broken down to its molecular state. Worked against the Necrons pretty well. Also took out a bunch of, as is traditional with the AdMech, a bunch of AdMech vessels at the exact same time.
Well, it's crazy because of this, I don't even know if because of this, they start just flinging Catan. So the C-Tan.
Yeah, the Necrons respond by going, here's all the shards of C-Tan.
And these, if you play 40K, these are not the ones you see on the tabletop. These are big, holy crap. Yeah. Did you just bane a battlecruiser? Yes.
Well, and one of the ones I liked in this is that one of the C-Tans actually could melt the mines of Skitarii and actually took out some Legio Titanicas, just had them almost shooting themselves. So the AdMech, though, love a one-up fight. And so the AdMech and the Necrons are just doing this. And we are right on the path of mutually assured destruction that's going to take out the Nephilim sector and maybe everything around it. My favorite one of them all was the Necrons shackled a dwarf star and flung it into an AdMech fleet.
They basically trebucheted a dwarf star.
Yes. During it, by the AdMech did break one of the shackles, so it also did hit a bunch of Necron ships, but it doesn't matter. They were flinging a star at each other. Now, luckily, cooler heads prevailed, and Call sees this and realizes that we're going to lose not just a sector, but maybe a segmentum if this doesn't stop, and makes all the AdMech stop firing their stupid guns and just go back to normal battles. As I said before, We've now entered the part of GW writing that is the fight in Anchorman, because it escalates very quickly and kind of randomly. Now, GW is going to add in some more players here, and it's going to come off as, hey, what the hell just happened? Why did you guys speed up a bunch at the end of the cast? I'm not speeding up. This is literally how this stuff's written. What GW likes to do is they're not wrong in this, they're writing a battle sector. And the sector will start with a pitched battle between one, two, maybe three players. And they'll start adding more players in, like 90s Royal Rumble style, until everyone's engaged. And they do this not because they're poor writers. They do this because this game is meant to be all-encompassing of all factions. We can't have 24 factions in the game. Only three of them are playing in the lore. So they add
But this also makes sense because of the fact that the Necrons were stealing down the Rift, which meant that Chaos effectively wasn't allowed to play. With us breaking, I love the us again, I'm part of the Imperium. Yes. And with us breaking the pylons, it put Chaos back into the game.
Yeah. And so what happens is, to exactly Brad's point, these pylons come down, and now there's warp access again. And the forces of Chaos are kind of like, hey, we couldn't see this area. Now we can. What's going on? And there's a massive battle between the Imperium and this highly technologic Xeno race. And the Force of Chaos decide, well, this is interesting. And by Forces of Chaos, I mean one, Vashtor.
Vashtor. Vashtor, who is the arms broker of the warp, all things technology, demon engines, anything that's super powerful tech-wise, he wants to be part of it, wants to control it, so he can give it out to who he wants to.
The rumor is that Vashtor is the reason for the Dark Age of Technology. He is the one that created the problems within the Men of Iron. Abaddon, by the way, of note here, is still just basking in the glory that is him destroying Cadia, so he doesn't really care. Vashtor is going somewhere. He's like, yeah, go have at it. So Vashtor sees this because he wants to become the fifth Chaos God, the God of the machine spirit, for lack of a better definition. And he needs to do this. He needs a lot more power to flow to him, much like the other gods who are powered by the actions of the mortal beings. Vashtor is powered by the machine spirit and AIs of the galaxy, performing arcane and cruel actions.
He's like a vampire, an evil spirit, anything drawn by cruelty, fear, vengeance. He is all of this AI, all of this super powerful technological weapons being used on each other. That just brings him like a moth to flame. Yeah. He just has to be part of it.
At the same time, though, Magnus sees Vashtor go. And Magnus does know that there is a potential timeline in the future where Vashtor does become a fifth Chaos God. And we already have four Chaos Gods, which is more than Magnus wants in the first place. So he then deploys...
which is four more than
yeah, that's true, yeah. I would actually say it's five more. I say four is five more than he wants.
Yeah, too true. It's like,
he's not a fan. Yeah, and he's on their... And he's technically on their side. So he deploys with the Thousand Sun Sorcerers, who, by the way, not huge fans of being around Necron pylons. Doesn't go great for them. Can't anti their world, but they're doing it because they have to stop Vashtor. And then, just because it's funny, Fabius Bile discovers, so there's just a ton of genes.
Not to help anybody, I was about to say, to do terrible things to all the Fallen.
Because he just realized there's a ton of gene seed just sitting around on planets because the Space Marines took massive losses and went, yeah, I'm going to go there too. And that, by the way, is where this story line just ends. Now, unlike when we had the Yunari timeline where it ended and then other stuff happened, this has ended because they actually haven't advanced the storyline beyond this moment. So this is all going on current. So we are now at current 40K.
Woohoo!
Yep. The Necrons are fighting the Imperium, Chaos, and themselves. The Tyranids are not that far away. All of the Imperium is involved. All of Chaos is coming in. I don't know where Genius of the Occult are, but they're probably not that far out. And Tau are still in their little sector doing their Tau thing. But that's fine. And Votann hadn't. Yeah, Votann weren't. When Pariah was written, Votann weren't in the game yet. Right? Because Votann were 9th edition and Pariah is 8th edition. Yeah. So Votann weren't in the game yet. But with that, we're going to finish this because that's really all we have on it. Next week, though, is our 2-year anniversary of the Lorecast.
Who knew?
And rather than give up now and call it a success, we're going to continue on until it's not, I guess. We'll see. I mean,
they'll be sad that way.
Well, that's what you do, though. That's what every show is. Every show is, well, we're just going to keep going. People stop watching. And sometimes you're 3 seasons.
Till we live long enough to be the villain.
I was going to say, sometimes you turn into one of those soap operas where it's really, it's like 40 years old. Yeah.
Or we could be Game of Thrones season 8.
Yeah, 20 Lorecast 2041. You're dead, and I'm not doing this anymore either. Actually, I might be dead. See, 41, we're adding 20 years. Hopefully, I'm still alive, but there's two new hosts.
Yeah. just your son and somebody he met.
Exactly. So next week, you guys are going to get a double dose of episodes from us. First is you're going to get something on YouTube and Spotify where Brad and I are going to review all the stuff we messed up.
So many things.
Forgetting to hit record buttons, using the word literally so many times it actually bothers us to...
Brad. It hurts me so much because I have to listen to the cast as we're editing the stuff for YouTube. Whew.
Yeah. Other brutal. One is how incredibly loud a lozenge is in your mouth when the microphone's in front of you.
That's my bad.
Fun one.
That's
me. Yeah, and a lot more. But same time, next week, we're going to jump into what I think is the most important part of all 40K lore, the Ultramarines. So, Brad didn't know this, so I kept this a secret. So next week, we're going Boys in Blue. Everyone's been asking for it, and I was going to do it, but I had to wait for the proper time. And I was going to let it be Salamanders because Brad was dreaming that we were getting Vulcan, and we got Vulcan.
We did not get Vulcan.
It's that scene in Deadpool 3.
When he jumps off the...
No, it's the flame on. Ah, it's the wrong one.
I thought you were going to give the one where he jumps off the stool. Mary Lou Redman.
No, I love that one where it's like, he's going to say it, flame on.
Oh,
it's the wrong one. But yeah, so next week we're going to start our coverage of the Ultramarines, which I assume will last 2 to 3 months. It's going to be fun. I don't even know how we're going to get through
this. There's so many Ultramarines characters. That's the problem. We can do a cast on each one of them. We're just going to do Bobby G, Tigerius, Titus, Telia,
Harris,
Sakaris.
Yeah, it's Sakaris. I mean, it gets Calgar.
Vanishes, yeah.
It is brutal. It is the Ultramarines, for those of you who don't play them, I'm sorry. I'm kidding. Actually, I sold all my Ultramarines, but the Ultramarines are maybe the deepest faction in the game.
For they sure. have, They're the poster boys. Got,
yeah. And they weren't originally, though. It was the Imperial Fists, right?
Well, yeah. Blood Angels were for a long time also.
That's right. Because it was Blood Angels first, and then Imperial Fists, and then Ultramarines.
For a while. The Boys in Blue have been carrying.
Yeah. And what I would say is what you can tell is, as much as the Blood Angels were popular, once the Ultramarines got really, let me say it better. The Ultramarines got really popular around the same time that GW started expanding the named character part of the game.
Yeah.
And so the Ultramarines got all of the named characters. And some of them are ridiculous. Like the dude, he's only half a body who you put on top of one of your tanks.
Talion?
Was it Talion? No.
Yeah.
Is that right?
He's the one that could go in.
It wasn't Talion. No, Talion was a sniper. Was a sniper.
Who goes Who's in the guy? Thing?
Yeah, it's people are going to correct us. By the way, we're going to do, I don't know how we're going to do Ultramarines, guys. Obviously, I haven't written it yet, so it's going to be interesting. We may just do a chunk of Ultramarines and have to come back to them more later because, that is a long and involved thing. But I do love them.
Sergeant Kronos.
Yeah, he's only a sergeant, but you can put him on top of a Land Raider and make it hit on twos.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Yeah, it was a good times. There were some good times in the 8th edition. Anyway, so with that, this has been John Barsotti and Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you guys next week.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish up projects with GE-branded silicone sealants. Tub and tile silicone is 100% waterproof and offers same-day water readiness, making it perfect to use in kitchens and bathrooms. Shop our selection of GE sealants in-store and on Menards.com and save big. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to view all of our other great deals happening this week. Save big.